episode 4. I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti.
And this is Red Handed. And before we get going on this one, I would like to put out a bit of a caveat. I do not have a house that has a cupboard specifically for violins. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you can go back and listen to our minisode. Saruti and I got locked in a cupboard in my house, which we happen to call the violin cupboard.
Good joke. You do have violins in here, though.
We have 3 violins in here, but it's not just for violins. It's not like we have a million cupboards, and this one just happens to be the violin cupboard.
So, the Enfield Poltergeist case.
It's a good one.
It is a good one. It is a good one.
So we're taking a break from murder because we've had quite a lot of it and everyone needed a break after Suzanne Capper, especially Saruti and I.
Yeah, I think it took its toll on us. And anyone who does kind of, you know, a lot of true crime research, you know that it can get a bit heavy. So we're going to go for a really intriguing case, though, the Enfield story. So I'd say that the Enfield case is, would you agree, Hannah, arguably one of the most famous and undoubtedly, definitely in this country, the most thoroughly documented.
Oh, totally. I think it's
Poltergeist case.
I think the Amityville Horror is probably the most world famous Poltergeist case, but in the UK, Enfield definitely. I think maybe the Pontefract Monk is like, I don't know, would you say that's more famous or?
It is. I'd say that the Pontefract Monk case is more famous, but that one felt a bit more sort of friendly. He was a bit more cuddly. People liked him around that town. I feel like the Enfield one really put Enfield on the map as one of the most haunted areas after this story came out, alongside things like Amityville. And I think this Poltergeist definitely was a lot more sinister.
It's like quite a lot of Poltergeist cases, like you hear quite a lot of like there's be a haunted pub and like mugs get moved around and stuff, but everyone's like, oh, don't worry about it, it's just Mr. Jackson, it's no big deal. But this case is interesting because that's not how, it's not something they learned to live with, it was something that they wanted to stop.
Absolutely. And I think this is a really interesting case because, you know, if you're a skeptic, definitely like I am, it's interesting because this was the first one to allegedly have actual recordings of voices on tape. There were eyewitnesses, there's photographs.
And there's police interviews, like genuine like police constables have go into the house and say, I don't know what I've just seen.
I know, but we'll come on to what we think might have been going on there. Well, at least what I think what was going on there. But I think, you know, a bit of background into Poltergeist. So Poltergeist comes from the German words Polten, to make a racket, and Geist, which is ghost or spirit. So it literally translates into kind of noisy spirit or noisy ghost.
They do sound quite fun. I think the negative connotations of it do mainly come from the film Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's why spirits in general, you're much more likely to be afraid of them rather than just accepting, I think.
And I think,
no, you don't think anything?
No, I don't think anything.
Go. Ladies and gentlemen, Saruti doesn't think anything. Saruti has no thoughts. Okay, so let's crack on to the first event. The so-called haunting began on the 31st of August in 1977 and continued for 14 months at 284 Green Street in Enfield, North London, home to single mother Peggy Hodgson and her 4 children, Margaret, who was 14, Johnny, who was 10, Billy, 7, and Janet, who would be the main focus of the poltergeist activity, and she was 11. The family became so terrified, they took to sleeping in the same room downstairs, along with investigators from the press and the Centre for Psychical Research. Poltergeists are often associated with unhappy homes. I think the best example of that in like folklore is, have you seen An American Haunting?
Yeah.
Obviously, that whole film is about, it's about sexual abuse. It's about negative energy in a home manifesting in a supernatural way.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite common. It's something that comes up quite a lot. Poltergeists are often associated with girls who are about to hit puberty. Same thing with exorcisms. You often find that most, and can you name me one famous possession case that wasn't a pubescent girl? Because you've got Emily Rose, you've got the German one, they're all based on, what's her name?
Oh, I don't remember.
Do you remember
yeah,
name?
Yeah.
Like, of and course. She was just anorexic and abused by a priest.
Absolutely, and I think at this point also you see that a lot more women do kind of outwardly suffer from symptoms like this, and also this is roughly the kind of age where things like that take grip. I don't necessarily think that there was any sort of abuse or even mental health problems going on with this case. I think it was incredibly intelligent little girls who their dad had left them. They felt abandoned. It's probably not ghosts.
But it wasn't the picture of happiness. It wasn't a happy home.
No. So, as we mentioned, the father had left the family and only visited the children to kind of hand over child support money, and on more than one occasion would also bring his new girlfriend, which obviously upset everyone.
He sounds like an absolute piece of shit.
I know. I think he wasn't a great dad. The little boy, Johnny, was actually eventually sent to a school for troubled youths, and the reason for this was never really made clear, but this led to the mother, Peggy, displaying a sort of deep-seated mistrust for the state authority, and as she viewed them as taking her child away. And so it was, like you said, hardly a happy family situation. So on the 31st of August 1977, at about 9:30 p.m., Peggy heard a shuffling noise coming from the room where the children were supposed to be asleep. So she went to Janet and Billy's room to investigate, and she asked the children what all the noise was about, and Janet told them that their beds had gone all funny and began to shake up and down.
Peggy went back to her room only to hear more shuffling coming from Billy and Janet's room, accompanied by knocking. She went and asked again what the noise was, and Janet told her it was a chair. So Peggy took the chair downstairs. I would be furious. I can just see her being like, oh, fine, then I'll take the fucking chair. Like, just go to sleep. Kids are the worst. I would be beside myself. And the noise continues, and Peggy describes it as, where she would go on to later describe it as someone walking in slippers. So like a shuffly noise moving across the floor. And she goes back upstairs once again to question the children for a third time. When she opens the door, the chest of drawers by the bedroom moved 18 inches into the room before coming to rest.
And we're telling this as if these things happen. This is what she alleged was happening, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
I'm just saying.
Just suspend your disbelief for one moment, Sarisi. Come with me on a journey.
No. Okay, I'm listening.
The chest of drawers then moved towards the door as if it was trying to block Peggy's entry into the room, and she tried to push it back, but she couldn't. Peggy rushed the children downstairs, and after some deliberation goes to their neighbours, a married couple called Vic and Peggy, who are always referred to, and this is so adorable, Peggy next door. She says to Peggy and Vic next door, she says, someone's larking around and it isn't any of us.
So Vic then goes over to the Hodgson's house to put Peggy's mind at ease, but the knocking continues and seems to be following him around the house. He thought that it must have been coming from outside, but there was no one there to be seen. So Vic starts to run out of ideas, and so they decide to call the police. Now, two police officers arrive at the house to investigate what they thought was, you know, a standard domestic disturbance, only to be met with a room full of people who looked very much like they'd seen a ghost. Now, by this point, there's just some knocking going on. Yes, I know that the mother, Peggy, thinks that she's seen a chest of drawers move, the kids have been, you know, the beds have gone all funny, but the police come in and say that these people look terrified. That seems like a large jump to make.
Okay. Earlier this afternoon, we were locked in a cupboard and we were too embarrassed to call the fire brigade.
Yeah.
If you're going to your neighbour's house, you'd have to be terrified. Like, you would never go to your neighbour's house and be like, there's stuff.
But what terrified them? That's the thing.
Well, why would they make it up?
I don't know. We'll.
What purpose does that serve?
I don't know. We'll come on to that. But so Peggy explains that she thought her house was haunted and that things were moving around on their own. She's telling the police this.
See, this is where... Why would you bother embarrassing yourself in front of the police?
I believe that she's terrified. But I don't... It's not a ghost. It's not a poltergeist that's terrifying her. It's, you know, it's not those things. But.
So obviously the police constables assigned to Saruti School of Skepticism.
Bloody good. The police come round and they're like, shit, your house is haunted. Why don't call us? Imagine.
So they didn't believe her, and Vic next door suggested turning off the lights to see if anything would happen.
Good one, Vic.
Yeah, I mean, that's a bit... I was like, oh, well, let's just turn off the lights and all get really hysterical.
What was that guy's name who used to do the British version of Ghost Hunters? Like... people are screaming.
McKenna, something McKenna.
Oh, Derek McKenna?
Derek, something like that.
Something. Yeah. What was it? Someone.
Darren McKenna?
I don't know. Wasn't that the guy who talked about diets?
No, that's... Paul McKenna will make you thin. That's what I mean.
Paul McKenna will make you thin by terrifying you with ghost stories.
As soon as he turned the lights off, four loud knocks came from one of the walls, and then two moments of silence, and then four more from the opposite side of the room.
This Janet.
Guy Lyon Playfair... What a name. Who is the author of This House is Haunted, which details... it's everything you need to know about the case, but it is quite boring. Because there's so many things that happen over the space of 14 months. There's only so many times you can read about marbles flying around. So I read it, so you don't have to. He claimed that the light from the street lamp was enough for everyone to plainly see each other, to see if there's no funny business going on, I would assume. They all searched the house, finding nothing and no one out of place, until the two constables witnessed a chair wobbling on its own before sliding 4 feet, just as the chest of drawers had done earlier that evening. So why would the police lie?
It's not lying, but it's like eyewitness testimony is just some of the worst. It's the worst testimony. It means nothing. It's the worst, weakest form of evidence because we... Okay, there's the eyewitness memory side of things, and then it's also what people see in real time or what they think they see, because we have this thing called like top-down processing, which is how we like deal with something that's happening in front of us, and it is completely informed by our beliefs and by our past experiences and things like this. And I think there's also a thing that I was reading about called I've forgotten something blindness, basically, and it means that no, it's that top-down processing, how we see things. And then on top of that, the reason eyewitness testimony is so shit is because the way that our memory works. So it's like we think that our brains act like a video recorder. It records something and then we just play it back on cue. But it's not. It's those memories get fragmented because every time you access a memory, every time you remember something, you're remembering the last time you remembered it. So it's like Chinese whispers in your own head. So, and there's just the fact that, you know, psychologists during the satanic panic, we proved that we could implant memories in people, all those recovered memories and things like that. Like, I just think the memory side of things makes eyewitness testimony so poor, and also the hysteria and this, like, the way that our opinions of what we're seeing can be formed around what we're thinking. Even in the book Playfair, he says that he uses Kramer, a psychiatrist's case study, as an example, and he says in there the poltergeists never seem to haunt atheists. And
right, I used to be a teacher in Costa Rica, and my student, obviously it's a Catholic country, my students were very open to the idea of not believing in God, and they would debate that with me very openly. But as soon as you brought up demons, they'd be like, no teacher, they're real. They couldn't quite disconnect, and you can't really have one without the other. You can't.
But I think it's that idea of being open to that being real makes it much more likely that you'll see it.
And, oh, absolutely, yeah.
And also that idea of like people seeing things. So later on in the story, you know, Peggy next door would say things like a rod just materialized in front of her eyes, but it didn't really. It was because we have this thing like, you, when you see something and you notice it for the first time, it looks like it's the first time you're seeing it. And there's a word for it. It's like accidental blindness or something like that. When you see something and you realize that it's there, it's almost like it's materialized in front of us. Yeah. And because we're not capable of processing everything that's going on around us at all times. So I think that there are just like a myriad of things that could have been causing all of this, like from hysteria to the way that people's belief system was built at this time, and also just the fact of like eyewitness testimony being one of the main things that this whole case is built on is the weakest form. And the reason we believe eyewitness testimony is because of the horror and the shock and the emotion that is given off by the person that's telling the story.
Do you know what it reminds me of? It's like, you know, have you ever had it where you learn a new word and you've never heard this word before, and then after you've learned it, you see it everywhere?
Of course, absolutely. And it's, I think there's so many things that play into this, and I can't believe that it was because something was actually going on. But hey, there is more to this than eyewitness testimony, which we will go into, because you know, they're recordings, photographs, so we'll try to go through them as kind of methodically as possible.
Yeah, so the police, after seeing this chair slide across the floor, they say, it's now well after midnight, and the police say there was nothing they could do, unsurprisingly, and they left.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you would. So the Hodgsons now decided they were all going to sleep in the living room. And in the morning, everything seemed as if it had just gone back to normal. But that night, however, marbles started to be thrown across the room. Once clear that none of the children were doing it. But how was it clear that none of the children were doing it, though? I'd love to know that, because that seems like a classic trick, right? They're waiting until it's night again. They got a massive kick. I mean, imagine if you were a prankster kid. The police came to the house and looked freaked out. I feel like now it's time to step it up to the next level. So they're throwing marbles, or someone is throwing marbles. Marbles are flying. So Peggy, once again, runs next door. Vic and Peggy next door also witnessed the marbles and pieces of Lego flying around the living room and noticed that once they came to a rest, they were red hot. Okay. All right. You're giving me a look. No, but the police now stop in again, as they had promised to do the night before, and attempted to calm the children, explaining, it's just one of those things, and there's no need to be afraid. I mean, yeah, I don't think the kids were afraid. There's a great picture that I'm going to put up on the Instagram, which is of the three children that's taken during this time. And the two kids, I think it's Johnny and Margaret, genuinely do look quite scared. Janet, standing in the middle, looks excited by this. Okay, so the flying marbles and Lego continued for the next three full days. And on Sunday the 4th of September, Peggy, who's at her wit's end now, decided that the only way to get help would be call the Daily Mirror.
This is where I step into the Sarita School of Cynicism here. I think, like, I don't know why you would call the press in the first place. I especially don't know why you would ring the Daily Mirror of all of them.
But I do think that, you know, their background, that's probably what the newspaper they were reading.
Also, fun fact, did you know that the first ever article published about the Amityville Horror, guess which magazine it was in?
Tatler.
Good Housekeeping.
What?
That's serious.
That's so strange. But no, I actually can understand why she calls the press, because I think that the police are not being very helpful. Because what can the police do, realistically? I don't know, I guess at this time, a woman like her, I would maybe have expected her to go to the church, but she doesn't, and she decides to go to the Daily Mirror.
A questionable decision at best, I would say.
And the Mirror send photographer Graham Morris, and he spent the Sunday night with the Hodgsons in the house, and though convinced something odd had happened, nothing went on while he was there, and he left about 2:30 in the morning. But, surprise, surprise, as soon as he left, the Lego started flying again and Peggy runs out into the street to catch him. And when he returned, he did manage to capture the very famous pictures of Lego and marbles flying through the air. And in the pictures that are really iconic, it kind of does look like they are floating. It doesn't look like they're on a trajectory. And he also got smacked in the head with a brick of Lego, not an actual brick. But I imagine that would probably hurt, I think.
Oh, it would. But again, kid... Janet.
But where I do have time for the photographer, though, because he, in the Channel 4 documentary, he talks about going and seeing these things flying through the air and not being able to explain it. And then he speaks about later, which we'll come on to, about when the voice starts happening. He says, never had time for the voice, never believed it for a second. So that makes me more inclined to believe there was something about the marbles and Lego, and maybe that was actually real because he bought into that, but he didn't buy into the voice.
I don't know. And I have like scrolled down to check the word I was trying to find because I added it into the notes before. It's inattentional blindness, when we don't see something in a room and then we suddenly see it. So, okay, it doesn't really fit with the explanation of the marble and the Lego bricks flying. But with things like suddenly appearing in different places where they're not meant to be and things like that, that really fits with that.
And also what I have just thought of, it's pretty good for his photography career.
That's what I was going to say. He's like, that's bullshit, but my photos, they're legit. I don't think that a guy from the Daily Mirror who's gone over there to be the photographer for this potentially quite high profile case, in terms of, you know, readership, is going to say, oh yeah, my photos were bullshit. But then why call into question the voice at all? Maybe because it was so ridiculous. I mean, we'll come on to the voice, but it was recorded, and, you know, to this day, it still remains something that people, like, actually have time for as a case in itself. So
Morris would go on to capture the even more iconic images of Janet supposedly flying through the air. We've already put those on Instagram, have a look at them. And she's supposedly possessed by the poltergeist in these.
She looks like she's jumping off the bed.
I feel like I could very easily recreate that photo.
We could go upstairs right now and recreate that picture, because I think there's been a lot of, like, analysis of that photo. People have taken it apart, and her sort of, like, positioning of her legs, her arms, the way her hair's moving, just seems that she's pulling a very good face in it.
She's good at faces, though.
She is good at faces, and I think that if the story once again is built on these photos, like Janet levitating above her bed, which absolutely looks like she's jumping, once again, it's not a solid case, but it is a good story and it is a good picture.
Morris attempted over the course of the haunting to photograph the furniture being thrown around, as we've heard several times, but despite being, you know, top of his game photographer at the Daily Mirror, never managed to capture it. He only managed to capture the furnishings as they came to rest, which again, pretty fucking convenient. If we spoke through every occurrence of something moving in the Green Street house, we'd be here for 10,000 years, so let's just get to the good bits.
So the Daily Mirror now call in the Society for Cyclical Research and ask them to send over a paranormal researcher. They sent a very esteemed member of their society, Mr. Maurice Gross. So I think it's really important to know a bit of background about Maurice and the context within which and the mindset with which he comes into this case. A month before he was called to Enfield, there was a tragic incident for Maurice. His daughter, who was just 22, was killed in a motorbike accident, and the cause of her death was severe head trauma. And I think the reason we bring this up is that there was a lot of coincidental circumstances around her death. And I think you mentioned that none of the documentaries...
Really? No. In every documentary, Maurice Gross just sort of swans in as this, like, bastion of psychical knowledge, and they don't really dig into his, like, credibility that much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Not that I think it discounts his research and his tapes and stuff, but, like, I think the reason for him wanting it to be true is very important.
His reason for needing this to be true, I feel like it comes into. And so, really what happens here is the day of the accident in which his daughter dies, Maurice's son receives a birthday card from his sister wishing him happy birthday. And we'll post a picture of this birthday card on the Instagram because I think it's really interesting. On the card, there's a cartoon on the front of the card of a disgruntled looking girl with bandages on her head, predicting almost his daughter's death.
That's what Gross thought.
That's what Gross thought, mm-hmm. Yes. Well, this is what he thinks after. And also, the day of the accident, apparently, clocks in the house that had stood still for years began to tick. Family members had very vivid dreams of drowning, and wind chimes would sound on still days. So, I don't know. This is all very light.
Why do you have a clock in your house that doesn't work?
I guess, like some people have, like, antique clocks and they don't want them ticking all day, so they'll just, like, have a beautiful clock in the house, but it won't work. Or, like, have clocks that are all set to different times so they don't chime at the same time.
Okay.
But Gross began to wonder whether his daughter had in fact survived her physical death and was attempting to contact him. And the biggest coincidence?
Da-da-da.
Maurice's daughter was also called Jan. So I think this is weird. I think birthday card that comes to the brother the day of the accident with the bandages around the girl's head on the front cover, and the fact that inside the card it says something weird, didn't it? Like, I was going to make it, but I landed on my head.
Something like that,
on my head. We'll post it on the Instagram. I think it's interesting. And it's the fact that it arrives at the house the same day she dies from severe head trauma by falling off.
Yeah,
a motorbike.
And she's called Janet.
She's called Janet. So I really feel like Maurice comes into this house, feeling like it needs to be real. Because if it's not real, and there is no afterlife, there is nothing more than what we see, his daughter Janet's just gone.
Yeah. And so obviously he feels this personal connection to the case. And Gross dedicated the next 2 years of his life to the Enfield haunting. And he has a job. He ran a business. This was like his hobby. This was his spare time. And it's incredibly thorough what he goes into.
This became like his lifeline to his daughter Janet, though, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And he compiled a collection of tape recordings and observations. And it's the basis for every book, every film, every documentary on the subject. It's Maurice Gross's stuff that he collected. Every group of investigators who came to the house naturally assumed the children were playing tricks and somehow managing to fool the adults. Janet especially was caught out by Gross pretending to be asleep on a few occasions, even moving his tape recorder, not knowing it was rolling, and it captured her saying to her sister, "Let's play a trick on him." Maybe it was the kids.
It was. And even later on, Janet would go on to admit that she would say, maybe we were responsible for like 2% of what happened.
Mm.
2%? I mean, come on. The fact that they were even caught doing stuff, the fact that they admit they had hoaxed some of it, I think the kids were just up to no good. That's what they were doing. And I think it is like we were saying before, Maurice comes into this having lost a daughter, Janet, who he desperately needs to feel that he can contact, that he can find a way that she survives beyond her physical death in some external, you know, plane somewhere else. And I think Janet was an incredibly intelligent, sassy young girl.
She is sassy.
She like, is
TV
sassy.
Interviews with her.
Oh, she's like, so sassy. And I think she's lost her dad, has just abandoned her. And so I think Maurice comes in as this wonderful, lovely, fatherly figure who probably projects his love of his dead daughter Janet onto this girl.
He does look a bit cuddly, doesn't he?
He absolutely does. And I think, you know, for both of them, if this turns out to not be true, if this needs to end, they both lose what they need from this case.
Yeah, absolutely. Janet, she did sort of seem to be the epicentre of the haunting, and this is where the voice comes in. The spirit decided, when the spirit decided to speak, it would only do so through Janet, and things would fly off shelves when she walked past, and her bed would be thrown in the air. But no one ever captured this on film, so it is just eyewitness testimony, like, all of these things, apart from the tapes, like, just recordings, yeah. They're not film. However, this is my favourite bit of the whole thing. I like to call this the lollipop lady levitation.
Also, do people in other countries know what we mean by lollipop lady?
Do they even still exist?
Yeah, there's a lollipop lady who stands at the bottom of my road. When I walk my dog, I always hear she waves at me.
Aww.
So it's a little infant school. So lollipop lady is just like a person who stands with a giant stop sign that looks like a lollipop, wearing high vis, kindly person who helps kids cross roads.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's what a lollipop lady does.
Man.
I don't think I've ever seen a lollipop
man. Yeah, we used to have a lollipop man.
Did you?
Yeah, when I was in primary school.
Forefront of gender equality.
Absolutely.
In North Arts.
Always.
So this lollipop lady and another gentleman who didn't have a fun job claim to have seen through the window Janet levitating, like flat on her back, flying around the room. And there's an interview with the lollipop lady in one of the documentaries, and this lollipop lady talks about it. She said, I went home and I tried to do it and I just couldn't lift myself. Obviously, no, you can't, lollipop lady.
Immediately, is this person a credible eyewitness? Eyewitness testimony, as we talked about, incredibly flawed. Now, this woman, this lollipop lady, she doesn't seem to me like a credible witness.
I want it to be true.
I can see you really want this to be true, but it's not.
I know.
It's not. Yes, I think, again, you know, we kind of talked about this whole idea of, like, top-down processing, how this seems to affect a certain type of person and certain types of circumstances, you know, unhappy homes, people who maybe have a few more religious beliefs, things like that.
Mm.
And, you know, we talked about the kind of inintentional blindness where people see things kind of materialise in front of them, even though it's just because they've just realised that that thing is there, and that we as humans are not very good at processing everything that's happening around us all at once. And I think, again, the photos, nothing really proves anything.
Okay, but shall we look at what you could argue is the most convincing piece of evidence?
Okay, the video recording, the audio recording.
The voice, yeah.
The voice.
So this is the voice that comes through Janet.
Let me hear you say my name. Come on, let me hear you say my name.
Okay, I don't want to listen to it anymore because we're recovered. Stop it!
Oh, I've got sore throat as well. That quite hurt.
Come on.
I mean, there's been a lot of, again, analysis of this, and they're just saying that, you know, there was like a famous ventriloquist who examined it, and they were just like, she's throwing her voice. She's using, like, what is it, like, false?
Yeah, it's like, it's she's not, you, in order to make that noise, you're not using your voice box, you're using something else. And that's why if you do it too much, you'll go
hoarse.
Like,
false vocal cords or something like that. And yeah, it's easily recreated. Like, I just made that noise. Really, I just think.
Do you know what? In one of the documentaries, an interview with this lady who spends some time with Janet, she's like, and I went home and I tried to speak in the voice and I was hoarse for 2 days. And I was like, well, that doesn't make it real.
No, it doesn't. And also, once again, it's just like, it's because, okay, I'll give Janet full credit that she committed to this act.
Mm.
Right? She was like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to go all the way. And that's what freaked people out. Because if you did see an 11-year-old girl who was claiming to be possessed behaving like that, you would be freaked out. And I think, you know, that's basically what was going on. I guess some people felt that this was actually the least convincing part of it, because it almost seemed to go too far. But I actually think if you're going to believe anything, a recording and a video seems to be, to me, the most convincing part. And apparently, you know, in the tape and the video, it seems to, the disembodied voice seems to be captured on tape and video, seemingly coming from Janet without her even moving her mouth. And Gross claims that this was the first time that a ghost voice had been caught on tape. And like we just played it, you can hear that in pretty much every single documentary there is out there. And the first time Gross questions Janet on tape, you can, as we just played, kind of hear this dog barking, the voice coming from Janet, and goes on to answer Maurice's questions. And I think something really interesting is swears a lot. Mm-hmm. An 11-year-old girl, she wants to swear, she wants to get away with it. And what better way than to say that she's possessed? And later the voice would go on to claim to be a man called Bill, who was haunting the family because he believed that it was his house. He had died in number 284 Green Street after a hemorrhage in the chair in the front room. Now, the story was corroborated by Terry Wilkins, who came forward saying his father had indeed lived in that house and had indeed died in the chair in the front room and was indeed called Bill, just as the voice described. Now, how could Janet have known about this? But I think some of the interesting things here is like, okay, so is it Bill's mannerisms? Is it Bill's language and vocab and interests that come across? Mm. Because there are reports from this that Bill seems to have an interesting preoccupation with periods.
Yeah.
Does that sound like an old man, or does that sound like an 11-year-old girl that's probably going to start having her periods pretty soon, is wanting to ask questions? The swearing, maybe that's an old man. But apparently also he has the vocabulary of a child. Now, maybe he's, you know, a bit senile and it's gone backwards. Maybe. But also apparently he had some of the characteristics of Janet. Things like changing subjects very erratically. But again, that could be a senile old man. And by all accounts, Bill wasn't the nicest man. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
What I think is,
but how could she have known? That's the thing.
That's what I think, yeah. How could she possibly have known that this man who lived in the house before went
Peggy
blind?
Peggy next door. Peggy next door seems like a gossip. I feel like she's been talking about this at some point. Janet has overheard and uses. Janet's smart. But that's the biggest question to me, is how did Janet know that about Bill? How he died, where he sat. And again, there's two sort of arguments for this, is that nothing ever happened to the TV, even though other furniture was thrown around, other things were destroyed in the house. When I was a kid, I wouldn't break my TV.
No way.
Especially not back then. That would have been the equivalent to like an iPhone, an Xbox, whatever the kids have got these days. And I think, but again, the son would say, well, Bill loved to sit in that chair and watch TV. I don't know.
There are several TV interviews. You could lose hours on YouTube with this, where Bill the Ghost seems to speak through Janet, but she has quite a spectacular overbite. I mean, it is really something.
She does.
So even when she's speaking as herself, you can't really see her mouth move. Like, she's got this sort of permanent smile because she has such an overbite. So even if she was the best ventriloquist in the world, it's not that difficult to cover it up, because even when she's actually talking, her mouth doesn't move, let alone when she's throwing her voice. She just looks like she's constantly smiling. Maurice Gross was convinced the voice cannot have been Janet messing around, and to prove this, he asked Janet to put water in her mouth, covered her mouth with tape, and the spirit voice spoke as if totally unaffected. After the experiment was finished, Janet spat out the water, proving it had been in her mouth the entire time. Never on film, don't believe it, next.
Yeah, and I also feel like, okay, if a spirit's going to possess you to use you as literally a mouthpiece, doesn't it also need your mouth to speak? Because otherwise, couldn't the disembodied...
Oh, that's a good point. I don't know.
Couldn't the disembodied voice, then why does it need to possess anybody at all if it can just, you know, if Bill can just vent his voice out when Janet can't speak? I don't know.
That's smoke and mirrors, though.
So the Society of Psychical Research, a documentary that they made with interviews as Janet as an adult, she is quite terrifying with
me. Oh, yeah, she really, really is.
I mean, not to, like, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, make fun of people's appearance or anything like that, and we're not doing that.
But she knows what she's doing there, because it's that ice white hair.
I know, but like... I did also read a thing that the person who had been involved in the interview when she had been on This Morning said that she was terrified and that she was shaking like a leaf. And because the woman was wondering, who had been the kind of, like, producer on This Morning, was saying, what possessed this woman? What made this woman come into a situation where she clearly feels so uncomfortable? Because she was apparently shaking, she was incredibly nervous, and after the show had finished recording, this producer felt so scared for how she looked that she went up and hugged her. She was shaking like a leaf, apparently. So I don't know, but then someone who as a child seemed to be, it's like almost the start as a joke, and then this just fucked her up so much that she's now seemed like a very strange adult.
Because they did, the Society of Psychoanalysts, they did tests on her and stuff. They sort of took her off and ran all these things, and that's going to fuck anyone up.
It is, and I don't know. It's weird. If you can, you can see the interview on YouTube really easily. You can see the interviews of her as a child. It's all really interesting. But I think here, really, if you're going to say, we can really apply Occam's razor here. If we're going to say that there's two possible sort of scenarios, two possible options with this case, one is that it was an actual haunting. The other is that the girls were playing a hoax. Those are the only two options, I think, that are available here. And then we have to say the one that needs the fewest assumptions made, the one that is simpler, is the right one. And to me, if we're going to apply that, then absolutely it's that the girls were hoaxing this. Because it's asking me to make too many leaps of faith. It's asking me to make too many assumptions. And also, there just isn't enough evidence here. And I know people will be like, oh, but there's recordings, there's tapes, there's eyewitness testimony, there's photographs. What more do you need? But all of those, really, if you break it down, seem really fundamentally flawed.
I know. Like, I so wanted this to be true.
I know.
And it just isn't. Sorry, folks at home. Also, do not bother with The Conjuring 2. It's absolutely fucking terrible.
It is. The Conjuring 1, great.
Fantastic.
And I've heard good things about Annabelle 2 that's coming out next month.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Apparently it's meant to be really good.
But also, like, Ed and Lorraine Warren came nowhere fucking near this. Like,
no.
And there was no pointy nose nun demon.
No, that was such a strange addition to this. And I think how this compares to Amityville, I actually think Amityville is such an interesting case, just because there was a legit, you know, 6 murders, an entire family massacred. And it was a get-out clause for that guy. He was just like, shit, I murdered my entire family for whatever reason, and probably money and other things. And then now, you know, he concocts the story of a demon who made him kill his entire family. Yeah. Then I love how that progresses, though, when it's like the next family move in, and then the lawyer's like, you know, can you say that all these things are happening in the house, all these ghostly goings on, and they try to cut him out of the deal, and it all just kicks off. I think the Amityville Horror is a fantastic story. But this is a really interesting case, because this girl, 11 years old, was able to create a media sensation in this country. The story was constantly making headlines. You know, the Daily Mirror, like, put a whole photographer out here on, like, you know, retainer to take photos and be with the family. Always in the media, the Society for Psychical Research, they had sent somebody out there. Maurice Gross was a really well-renowned paranormal investigator. And do you think he may have approached this case and looked at this differently had his daughter not died a month before?
Yeah, I absolutely think that. Yeah. I think he would have been interested in it, but I think it would have been more of a passing interest. I don't think he would have dedicated two years of his life to it.
No, I think this was like a perfect storm. So thank you very much for listening to episode 4.
From the cupboard,
which is where we will be coming to you from now on. Please do follow us on @redhandedthepod on Instagram and on Twitter. We will be, you know, announcing all the next episodes we'll be doing. We'll be letting you know first when an episode drops. So, you know, it's a really nice community forming there. So please do go join us. And also please, if you like what we're doing, rate, review and subscribe us. It really helps us out, especially as we're just getting started.
Okay, so we'll see you next time in the cupboard.
And next time we will be talking about Helen Bailey, the woman who was very tragically murdered by her fiancé.
It's quite a twisty turny one, that one, so...
It is. So be sure to join us then. Thanks.
Bye.